Chapter 49. Looks after Oliver and proceeds with his adventures. Wolves tear your throats. ... muttered Sykes, grinding his teeth. I wish I was among some of you. You'd howl the hoarser for it. ... Sykes growled forth this imprecation. With the most desperate ferocity that his desperate nature was capable of, he rested the body of the wounded boy across his bended knee, and turned his head, for an instant, to look back at his pursuers. There was little to be made out in the mist and darkness, but the loud shouting of men vibrated through the air, and the barking of the neighboring dogs, roused by the sound of the alarm bell, resounded in every direction. Stop, you white-livered hound! ... cried the robber, shouting after Toby Crackit, who, making the best use of his long legs, was already ahead. Stop! ... The repetition of the word brought Toby to a dead standstill, for he was not quite satisfied that he was beyond the range of pistol shot, and Sykes was in no mood to be played with. Bear a hand with the boy, ... cried Sykes, beckoning furiously to his confederate. Come back! ... Toby made a show of returning, but ventured, in a low voice, broken for want of breath, to intimate considerable reluctance as he came slowly along. Quicker! ... cried Sykes, laying the boy in a dry ditch at his feet, and drawing a pistol from his pocket. Don't play booty with me. ... At this moment the noise grew louder. Sykes, again looking round, could discern that the men who had given chase were already climbing the gate of the field in which he stood, and that a couple of dogs were some paces in advance of them. It's all up, Bill. ... cried Toby. Drop the kid, and show 'em your heels. ... With this parting advice, Mr. Crackit, preferring the chance of being shot by his friend to the certainty of being taken by his enemies, fairly turned tail and darted off at full speed. Sykes clenched his teeth, took one look around, threw over the prostrate form of Oliver the cape in which he had been hurriedly muffled, ran along the front of the hedge, as if to distract the attention of those behind from the spot where the boy lay, paused for a second before another hedge which met it at right angles, and whirling his pistol high into the air, cleared it at a bound, and was gone. Ho, ho, there! ... cried a tremulous voice in the rear. Pincher! Neptune! Come here, come here! ... The dogs, who, in common with their masters, seemed to have no particular relish for the sport in which they were engaged, readily answered to the command. Three men, who had by this time advanced some distance into the field, stopped to take counsel together. My advice, or, leastways, I should say, my orders, is, ... said the fattest man of the party, that we immediately go home again. ... I am agreeable to anything which is agreeable to Mr. Giles, ... said a shorter man, who was by no means of a slim figure, and who was very pale in the face, and very polite, as frightened men frequently are. I shouldn't wish to appear ill-mannered, gentlemen, ... said the third, who had called the dogs back, ... Mr. Giles ought to know. ... Certainly, ... replied the shorter man, and whatever Mr. Giles says, it isn't our place to contradict him. No, no, I know my situation. Thank my stars, I know my situation. ... To tell the truth, the little man did seem to know his situation, and to know perfectly well that it was by no means a desirable one, for his teeth chattered in his head as he spoke. You are afraid, Brittles, ... said Mr. Giles. I am, ... said Brittles. You are, ... said Giles. You're a falsehood, Mr. Giles, ... said Brittles. You're a lie, Brittles, ... said Mr. Giles. Now, these four retorts arose from Mr. Giles' taunt, And Mr. Giles Taunt had arisen from his indignation at having the responsibility of going home again, imposed upon himself under cover of a compliment. The third man brought the dispute to a close, most philosophically. "I'll tell you what it is, gentlemen," apostrophe said he, "we're all afraid." Apostrophe, speak for yourself, sir, apostrophe said Mr. Giles, who was the palest of the party. "So I do," apostrophe replied the man. "It's natural and proper to be afraid, under such circumstances." "I am." Apostrophe, "so am I," apostrophe said Brittles. "Only there's no call to tell a man he is, so bouncably." Apostrophe, these frank admissions softened Mr. Giles, who at once owned that he was afraid. Upon which, they all three faced about, and ran back again with the completest unanimity, until Mr. Giles, who had the shortest wind of the party, as was encumbered with a pitchfork, most handsomely insisted on stopping, to make an apology for his hastiness of speech. "But it's wonderful," apostrophe said Mr. Giles, when he had explained, "what a man will do, when his blood is up. I should have committed murder, I know I should, if we'd caught one of them rascals." Apostrophe, as the other two were impressed with a similar presentiment, and as their blood, like his, had all gone down again, some speculation ensued upon the cause of this sudden change in their temperament. "I know what it was," apostrophe said Mr. Giles, "it was the gate." Apostrophe, "I shouldn't wonder if it was," apostrophe exclaimed Brittles, catching at the idea. "You may depend upon it," apostrophe said Giles, that gate stopped the flow of the excitement. "I felt all mine suddenly going away, as I was climbing over it." Apostrophe, by a remarkable coincidence, the other two had been visited with the same unpleasant sensation at that precise moment. It was quite obvious, therefore, that it was the gate, especially as there was no doubt regarding the time at which the change had taken place, because all three remembered that they had come in sight of the robbers at the instant of its occurrence. This dialogue was held between the two men who had surprised the burglars, and a traveling tinker who had been sleeping in an outhouse, and who had been roused, together with his two mongrel curs, to join in the pursuit. Mr. Giles acted in the double capacity of butler and steward to the old lady of the mansion. Brittles was a lad of all work, who, having entered her service a mere child, was treated as a promising young boy still, though he was something past 30. Encouraging each other with such converse as this, but keeping very close together, notwithstanding, and looking apprehensively round, whenever a fresh gust rattled through the boughs, the three men hurried back to a tree, behind which they had left their lantern, lest its light should inform the thieves in what direction to fire. Catching up the light, they made the best of their way home, at a good round trot, and long after their dusky forms had ceased to be discernible, the light might have been seen twinkling and dancing in the distance, like some exhalation of the damp and gloomy atmosphere through which it was swiftly borne. The air grew colder, as day came slowly on, and the mist rolled along the ground like a dense cloud of smoke. The grass was wet, the pathways, and low places, were all mire and water, the damp breath of an unwholesome wind went languidly by, with a hollow moaning. Still, Oliver lay motionless and insensible on the spot where Sykes had left him. Morning drew on apace. The air became more sharp and piercing, as its first dull hue the death of night, rather than the birth of day, glimmered faintly in the sky. The objects which had looked dim and terrible in the darkness, grew more and more defined, and gradually resolved into their familiar shapes. The rain came down, thick and fast, and pattered noisily among the leafless bushes. But Oliver felt it not, as it beat against him, for he still lay stretched, helpless and unconscious, on his bed of clay. At length, a low cry of pain broke the stillness that prevailed, and uttering it, the boy awoke. His left arm, rudely bandaged in a shawl, hung heavy and useless at his side. The bandage was saturated with blood. He was so weak that he could scarcely raise himself into a sitting posture. When he had done so, he looked feebly round for help and groaned with pain. Trembling in every joint, from cold and exhaustion, he made an effort to stand upright, but, shuddering from head to foot, fell prostrate on the ground. After a short return of the stupor in which he had been so long plunged, Oliver, urged by a creeping sickness at his heart, which seemed to warn him that, if he lay there, he must surely die, got upon his feet and essayed to walk. His head was dizzy, and he staggered to and from like a drunken man. But he kept up, nevertheless, and, with his head drooping languidly on his breast, went stumbling onward, he knew not whither. And now, hosts of bewildering and confused ideas came crowding on his mind. He seemed to be still walking between Sykes and Crackett, who were angrily disputing for the very words they said, sounded in his ears. And when he caught his own attention, as it were, by making some violent effort to save himself from falling, he found that he was talking to them. Then, he was alone with Sykes, plodding on as on the previous day, and as shadowy people passed them, he felt the robber's grasp upon his wrist. Suddenly, he started back at the report of firearms. There rose into the air loud cries and shouts. Lights gleamed before his eyes. All was noise and tumult, as some unseen hand bore him hurriedly away. Through all these rapid visions, there ran an undefined uneasy conscious of pain, which wearied and tormented him incessantly. Thus he staggered on, creeping, almost mechanically, between the bars of gates, or through hedge gaps as they came in his way, until he reached a road. Here the rain began to fall so heavily that it roused him. He looked about, and saw that at no great distance there was a house, which perhaps he could reach. Pitying his condition, they might have compassion on him, and if they did not, it would be better, he thought, to die near human beings, than in the lonely open fields. He summoned up all his strength for one last trial, and bent his faltering steps towards it. As he drew nearer to this house, a feeling came over him that he had seen it before. He remembered nothing of its details, but the shape and aspect of the building seemed familiar to him. That garden wall, on the grass inside, he had fallen on his knees last night and prayed the two men's mercy. It was the very house they had attempted to rob. Oliver felt such fear come over him when he recognized the place that, for the instant, he forgot the agony of his wound and thought only of flight. Flight. He could scarcely stand. And if he were in full possession of all the best powers of his slight and youthful frame, whither could he fly? He pushed against the garden gate. It was unlocked, and swung open on its hinges. He tottered across the lawn, climbed the steps, knocked faintly at the door, and, his whole strength failing him, sunk down against one of the pillars of the little portico. It happened that about this time, Mr. Giles, Brittles, and the tinker were recruiting themselves, after the fatigues and terrors of the night, with tea and sundries, in the kitchen. Not that it was Mr. Giles' habit to admit to too great familiarity the humbler servants, towards whom it was rather his wont to deport himself with a lofty affability, which, while it gratified, could not fail to remind them of his superior position in society. But, death, fires, and burglary make all men equals, so Mr. Giles sat with his legs stretched out before the kitchen fender, leaning his left arm on the table, while, with his right, he illustrated a circumstantial and minute account of the robbery, to which his bearers, but especially the cook and housemaid, who were of the party, listened with breathless interest. It was about 2:30, said Mr. Giles, or I wouldn't swear that it mightn't have been a little nearer 3, when I woke up, and, turning round in my bed, as it might be so, here Mr. Giles turned round in his chair, and pulled the corner of the tablecloth over him to imitate bedclothes, I fancied I heard a noise. At this point of the narrative the cook turned pale, and asked the housemaid to shut the door. who asked riddles, who asked the tinker, who pretended not to hear. Apostrophe heard a noise, apostrophe continued Mr. Giles. I says, at first, this is illusion, and was composing myself off to sleep, when I heard the noise again, distinct. Apostrophe, what sort of a noise? Apostrophe asked the cook. A kind of a busting noise, apostrophe replied Mr. Giles, looking round him. More like the noise of powdering a iron bar on a nutmeg grater, apostrophe suggested Brittles. It was, when you heard it, sir, apostrophe rejoined Mr. Giles, but, at this time, it had a busting sound. I turned down the clothes, continued Giles, rolling back the tablecloth, sat up in bed, and listened. Apostrophe, the cook, and housemaid simultaneously ejaculated lore. Apostrophe and drew their chairs closer together. I heard it now, quite apparent, apostrophe resumed Mr. Giles. Somebody, I says, is forcing of a door, or window, what's to be done? I'll call up that poor lad, Brittles, and save him from being murdered in his bed, or his throat, I says, may be cut from his right ear to his left, without his ever knowing it. Apostrophe, here, all eyes were turned upon Brittles, who fixed his upon the speaker, and stared at him, with his mouth wide open, and his face expressive of the most unmitigated horror. I tossed off the clothes, apostrophe said Giles, throwing away the tablecloth, and looking very hard at the cook and housemaid, got softly out of bed, drew on a pair of apostrophe, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.